Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, we are honored to have our very special guest, Sheriff Bill Gore. He's been sheriff since 2009 when he was appointed to fill a vacancy. He was elected in 2010 and re-elected in 2014. He has a 44-year career in law enforcement, including 32 years in the FBI, where he rose to serve as assistant director and helped pioneer a cybercrime squad and joint terrorism task force in the Seattle field office. He's also a Navy veteran with roots right here in San Diego, having received his bachelor's at the University of San Diego before getting a master's in public policy at Seattle University. He comes from a law enforcement family. His father and a brother served with the San Diego Police Department. Another brother formerly served as a San Diego County Deputy Sheriff, and his wife was one of the first women FBI agents. Sheriff Gore, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mary. It's good to be here.
Let's start by asking, I guess, the obvious question. How does the crime rate today in San Diego County compare to when you took office about 9 years ago?
Well, it's a good news story, Miriam, which is very nice. I'm very proud of the hard work of the men and women of the San Diego County Sheriff's Department, and I think that hard work is really reflected in the crime rates. I'm very proud to say that crime really in San Diego County is probably at a 35-40-year low.
Very good.
I always like to put numbers with that instead of just dealing with generalities.
Sure, facts are good.
When you look at let's take the last 5 years going back to 2012, from 2012 to 2016. The 2017 statistics are not out. These are the FBI statistics that all local law enforcement submits through SANDAG to FBI. So what we have are the 2016 statistics. But I'm really proud to say that in the jurisdiction covered by the sheriff, it's important to, I think, for your listeners to realize that the sheriff's department polices for about 1 million people in San Diego County. We police for all of unincorporated San Diego County, which is just under 500,000. And then we have contracts with 9 incorporated cities to provide police services. And that's about another 500,000 people. So
huge area, yeah.
It's a lot of people. And I think we're doing a pretty good job. When you look at SANDAG every year does the crime statistics, reporting the Part 1 crimes to the FBI, which it puts us all on a level playing field. So I can compare my county or the city of San Diego with Baltimore and New York. In San Diego, for example, in my jurisdiction, in the last 5 years, 2012 to 2016, crime in the sheriff's jurisdiction is down 24%.
Wow, that's very impressive.
And what's really exciting about that, they do a statistic, a crime rate. It's how many crimes per 1,000 people you have committed in your jurisdiction. And you've heard Chief Zimmerman from San Diego Police Department talk about low crime rates in the city of San Diego.
Sure.
It's one of the safest big cities in the country. I like to say that San Diego County is probably the safest urban county in the country. Our overall crime rate in the jurisdiction of the Sheriff's Department is 15 crimes per 1,000 people.
Wow.
It's Part 1 crimes. Now, when you look at the city of San Diego doing a great job for a major city, theirs is 24.
Wow.
So the crime rate for the sheriff's jurisdiction, the 1 million people we police for in San Diego County, is the lowest of all the jurisdictions of San Diego County. 15 crimes per 1,000 people. That's even lower than the city of Coronado, which is 16.8 crimes per 1,000. So I'm very proud of the hard work of the men and women of this department and how in the last 5 years, like I said, they've lowered that crime rate by 24%.
That's very impressive, Sheriff Gore. How has your department managed to take such a big bite out of crime?
Well, I think it's a lot of hard work by the men and women of the Sheriff's Department, but I think we've really embraced the intelligence or information-led policing model, taking advantage of the digital age we live in, the instantaneous crime reporting we have now with our automated records management system, and really hiring a lot of analysts in the Sheriff's Department. When I first came to the department in 2004, I believe we had about 8 analysts, crime analysts. Today in the Sheriff's Department, we have 34 crime analysts, and they have partnered with our sworn deputies to really address the crimes in our jurisdiction and work hand in glove to try to be proactive and not just reacting to crime. We use that proactive approach in allocating our resources to where the crimes are. And then a great example is maybe catching that residential burglar on the second or third burglary instead of the 20 or 23rd burglary, which so many times happens. So it really keeps the number of victims in our community down and makes us all much, much safer.
Now, in addition to utilizing technology to fight crimes, I understand that you've also led efforts to coordinate the work of multiple law enforcement agencies in the county. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. In my FBI career, I had the good fortune of working all over the United States, and I can tell you that what we have here in San Diego is truly unique. And I say what we have is a cooperative and collaborative relationship between all levels of law enforcement, not just the Sheriff's Department getting along with San Diego PD. It's federal, state, and local all coming together. And when we look at crime problems, we try to regionalize that crime problem so we're not duplicating efforts or reinventing the wheel, whether it's drugs, white-collar crime, cyber crimes, terrorism. We come together in a task force environment with federal prosecutors and state prosecutors. Everybody checks their ego at the door, and when we're all done, we take a bow at a press conference, and I think that is a big contributor to our record low crime rates here. I'm particularly proud because I think I played a significant role in that, both in my FBI career and as the sheriff. In 1998, for example, I formed the first cybercrime squad in the FBI, and working with the United States Attorney, we had the first regional computer forensics laboratory in the country. We brought all of federal, state, and local law enforcement together to address this very important part of investigating all crimes, and that's computer forensics. Now there's 23 of those regional computer laboratories around the country based on what we did right here in San Diego. I also started the first Joint Terrorism Task Force, and I was instrumental in putting together the Law Enforcement Coordination Center, which is, again, is an information-led task force that deals with crime in San Diego County.
Very good. A couple of years ago, when we interviewed you last, Sheriff Gore, we had done a public records search on response times in East County, and we found that in some of the rural areas, there were some pretty long response times out there, even for, you know, for fairly serious crimes. I'm wondering if you can provide an update. Have those response times improved in places like, you know, Campo and Boulevard?
Sure. As you know, Miriam, you're very familiar with our rural San Diego County. It's very challenging. It's a lot of territory out there, not the best roads in the world. And our deputies live on the beat, so to speak. And they work from, their shifts are barely 8 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night. If something happens at 2 in the morning, they get up, they get dressed, and they respond. But I'm happy to say, in light of that, we are making improvements.
Good.
We categorize our calls by category 1 and 2, where there's threat to life and serious injury.
Right, I think we've looked at the top 2 categories anyway.
And we've managed to cut 7 minutes off our response time from last year to this year.
Good.
The average response time now is 19 minutes, where before it was 26 minutes. So, which is not bad when you consider the area that these deputies are covering. This is policing, you know, from 50, 60 years ago, where they're, it's a good type of policing. You talk about community, but they're a part of the communities. They live where they're policing, unlike so many of our deputies in the urban environment. So we've got about 34 deputies now that cover our rural area from Borrego to Campo and everything in between.
So that includes every mountaintop and Box Canyon out there, as well as the urban areas, which explains why it's you know, a little longer than it would be in the
city. We know it's a concern. We're always trying to work on improving those numbers. We're getting there. But it's a real challenge because of the vast territory. Well, the county is 4,300 square miles, and I think rural area that these 34 deputies cover is probably 2,600 square miles of that. So there's a lot of area to cover.
In an ideal world, how many deputies would you need to get the response time to be what you would consider ideal?
Well, the problem would be that there's just infrequent calls. You'd have a deputy that would just be sitting there for, you know, inordinate amount of time waiting for the radio to, especially at 2 in the morning. You might go 2 or 3 nights and nothing happens. So it's a balance. I realize when your house has been burglarized, you want somebody there right away, and we're working on the best and most efficient response we can.
Okay. Thank you. And speaking of crime in the county, one of the sort of, I guess, dark spots on the San Diego region crime-wise is that we are one of the major human trafficking centers in the country. Can you tell us what your office is doing
Sure.
to address that and bring that down?
Yeah. In 2005, I was the assistant sheriff in the Law Enforcement Services Bureau, and we applied for and got the first federal grant to really study the problem, to educate law enforcement on the problem. Prior to that, there was a misconception that prostitutes involved with this or are part of this criminal activity. Mm-hmm. And it's been a whole different mindset now. Looking at these young ladies that are trafficked in this sexual exploitation are really the victims of this crime.
That's right. Yeah.
So it was a big education to law enforcement, and working with our friends at Pacific Lutheran University, identifying the magnitude of the problem. And it is significant here. We came together, again, as we usually do, in a human trafficking task force environment.
Yeah.
I was proud to partner with then District Attorney Bonnie DeMontis and now Summer Steffen, the current district attorney, along with Diane Jacob, who was a real driving force behind this.
Supervisor Jacob, yeah.
To form the Human Trafficking Task Force. I have detectives and supervisors assigned to that task force, and we're making a real impact. It's a big problem, but it's not just a law enforcement issue. It's working with schools, way down to the junior high school level, high schools, and all of our law enforcement partners to look at this problem.
I think it's been shocking to a lot of people to learn that these victims of human trafficking, they aren't just sort of career prostitutes. They're grabbing these girls out of shopping malls and off streets and grooming them online, you know, acting like they're the boyfriend. And so it's good to be learning about how people can protect these young girls from that.
I think one of the most concerning things that we've seen is the gangs that are moving into this illegal activity. It's the biggest moneymaker behind drug trafficking in the county.
So it's not just one pimp out there.
Right. And we see gangs do not cooperate on most issues, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
In this area, we've even seen them exchange these young ladies, these victims in this human trafficking. And they look at this as a very safe money-making venture, a lot safer than buying and selling drugs.
Wow.
And our challenge is to educate the public that this is not a victimless crime, that these women that are mostly women, sometimes young men,
mm-hmm.
trafficked in this terrible criminal activity are victims. And so it's a big challenge for us.
Yeah, well, very important issue. We did post on Facebook, Sheriff, that we were going to be interviewing you, and we asked some of our readers for suggestions for questions they would like to see answered. Some of them we've already asked, as well as some of our own. But one of our women readers wanted to know what's being done about untested rape kits. How many untested rape kits are there, and do you plan to test those?
Yeah, we had about 400 untested. When I say untested, these were what we call Category 4 or 5 kits. The identity of the perpetrator was not in question.
Oh.
So our judgment was, why spend the money to test those? But the laws have changed. We're going to test every one of them. We have a contract with a private lab to send those out. They're in the process of being sent out now, and we hope that within the next 6 months, every one of the backlog will be taken care of.
Very good. Thank you. Another issue that you've dealt with, one of the biggest challenges I would imagine that you've had to face, is dealing with prison realignment, which is the state, you know, under order of a judge, having to release a certain number of their prisoners and kick them back down to the county jails so they become your issue to deal with. Can you tell us how that's worked out? I know when we did an interview a couple of years ago, you talked about there being sort of a bump in the python here where you were going to have to release some prisoners. Crime would probably go up, but your prediction was at some point that would work its way through the pipeline and, you know, go down again as certain reoffenders got caught. So tell us how that's worked out.
Well, as you know, Miriam, we've talked about this before. It's probably the biggest change to criminal justice in the state of California in the last 50 years. And as you correctly identified, it was brought about by a Supreme Court order that said, California, you are severely overcrowded. And they were. Yeah. They had 170,000 inmates in a system that was built for 89,000. And consequently, they had poor medical care and poor mental health care in their facilities.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was the Supreme Court ordered them to downsize by 40,000 inmates. Well, they didn't take just 40,000 inmates and transfer them to county jails. What they did prior to 2011, if you were sentenced to a misdemeanor, a year or less, you went to a county jail. If you were sentenced for a felony, year or more, you went away to state prison. Well, that all changed with criminal justice realignment. Now, if you are sentenced to anything but the most serious and violent offense, you go to a county jail no matter the length of stay. So unless you were one of the most serious or violent offenders, you went to a county jail no matter the length of the sentence. And the Supreme Court gave the state of California 3 years to accomplish this downsizing. At the same time, I think it's important to remember that the state of California was going through a, I think, $20, $25 billion budget shortfall.
Yeah.
And secondly, the state was running one of the highest recidivism rates in the country of 72% of the people that were in state prison that were released were back in state prison within 3 years. So those were the challenges we were dealing with. Mm-hmm. And we came together as a public safety community in 2011 saying, if we're going to make this work, first of all, the state didn't give us enough money to make it work.
Of course.
Because they had the budget shortfall.
Right.
And second, we knew we couldn't continue to rotate these people through our jails like the state had been doing in their prisons. So everything we did focused on lowering that return to jail rate, that recidivism rate in our county jails. And when I say we came together, it was the public defender, the district attorney, the sheriff's department, county probation, the judiciary, all looking at what role we could play in lowering that recidivism rate. And what we all decided that the answer is to bring the services into our facilities to give the people that are in our custody the chance to be successful when they came out, whether that's substance abuse programming, literacy, anger management, you name it.
Yeah, you've even had some job training in there if they want to learn
absolutely
how to be a chef or a
the big
landscaper.
Part is so when they leave our facility, they have a chance to get a good paying job and support themselves so they're not stealing your car, burglarizing your house. Probably the underlying program that we found is critical for their successful reentry into our communities is what we call cognitive behavioral training. That's changing the way they think that got them into jail to start with. If you don't take care of that part, you might teach them how to read and write, and you've got, when somebody's released from prison, a crook now that can read and write. So that's the core of what we do, plus give them the other skills so they can be successful when they come back to our communities, because we have to remember 95% of the people that go away to prison and jails are coming back to our community.
So how has it worked out? Do you have any figures yet?
Yes, we do.
Okay,
and I'm pretty excited about that. And I think they can even get better. As I mentioned, the state was running at 72% recidivism rate. Our return to custody numbers after the last 3 years is at 36%.
Wow.
So we're on the right track. And I think we can get that even lower as we expand our programming. And we're always looking for partnerships with our community that we serve, whether it be the Restaurant Association that we've partnered with, the Carpenters Union that we've partnered with, to bring in the services into our facilities to give these people the tools they need when they leave our facilities.
Sounds like a wonderful program. One problem that's been in the news a lot has been that there have been 22 people who died either in county jails or while being taken into custody. And that's prompted 6 lawsuits that are pending. And the county has actually paid $6 million in settlements for deaths of some of those folks. There's also been some civil suits alleging that jail officials ignored suicide threats or used excessive force. So what is being done, Sheriff Gore, to reduce the number of deaths of people in custody and also be a little more transparent so that media or the public knows when this is happening and isn't just learning about it when somebody files a civil suit?
Well, all of our in-custody deaths are reported to the County Law Enforcement Review Board, so we're not hiding anything. They're all publicly available to clear. A lot of publicity was brought to this issue in 2013 and 14, a series of articles written in a local newspaper based on statistics that came from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is a federal organization.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that report came out, we felt like the methodology wasn't real accurate when they compared us to other jails. And as a result of some of these lawsuits, which based the lawsuit on the reporting in these various newspaper articles, we've gone out and really looked at those statistics, and we've done a lot of research. We brought in statisticians. And don't get me wrong, one death in our facility is too many. But I think that what we want to do is identify where we can improve, but paint a realistic picture and not have us as some outlier. And I think when you look at the report that's been prepared for us that talks about using the statistics from the Bureau that some of these articles were based on is not a good, accurate way to look at the number of jails and compare jails to prisons. First of all, you can't compare jails to prisons because of the shorter stay.
Right.
Some counties have police departments in those counties have city jails where people, when they're first arrested, go to a city jail. For example, Los Angeles PD has 10 jails of their own. In San Diego County, there are no local jails. If you get arrested, you come to one of our county jails. And that's a very high-risk time during the arrest of any inmate, is the first week to 2 weeks. Orange County, for example, Anaheim and Santa Ana have city jails. So, like I say, we're not making excuses. We're always trying to improve the services that we provide in our jails, our suicide prevention programs. But I would like to be compared fairly with other counties.
Your opponent is Dave Myers, who's worked in the sheriff's department himself for many years as a commander. He's had a couple promotions through the years, and he has said he thinks more needs to be done to increase diversity and community policing at the sheriff's department, especially with communities of color in these racially charged times that we're living in. Could you please address those issues, and do you have any statistics? Has diversity increased on your watch, and if so, by how much?
Yeah, I'm very proud, actually, of the work that this department has done in trying to accurately represent the communities we serve. I think that's important for the sheriff's department to meet those numbers and to reflect the communities that we serve, whether it be Latino or Asian Pacific Islander or Black in our community. I've heard my opponent's criticism, and I don't think his criticism are really based on the facts. I do have some numbers here so we can compare apples to apples.
Yes.
In our community, the Asian Pacific Islander population is 6.2% of the community that we're served by the Sheriff's Department.
Mm-hmm.
Our sworn personnel, their Asian Pacific Islanders, are 7.8%. So we have more than in the area we police. In African American population in our jurisdiction, the population that we serve is 3.0% African American. 6.3% of our sheriff's deputies are African American.
Very good.
Latino population, we don't quite make the mark there. 30% of our population that we serve are Hispanic, Latino.
Mm-hmm.
Deputy sheriffs, 28.7%. I'm not saying we can't always do better, and we're actively recruiting in these neighborhoods, trying to interest people in law enforcement.
But it generally reflects the demographic balance of the
county.
In
some areas, we're over. In the Hispanic population, we're under by about 1%. But I'm not going to be satisfied until we're at those numbers or above them, because I think it's so important to send that message to those communities.
Back to reducing the number of people who wind up in jail to begin with, I understand your department has done quite a bit to outreach and mentor at-risk youths. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, nobody, I think, works harder than public safety, than your deputy sheriffs and your police officers, to keep people out of the system. Nobody's more aware of this pipeline to prison than people in law enforcement. I have juvenile detectives and school resource officers that work tirelessly within the schools with teachers, parents, and kids to identify these at-risk kids to keep them out of the system. I'm on the board of the National Conflict Resolution Center, which came up with the concept of restorative justice. I spent $100,000 of my asset forfeiture money to give seed money to the first Center for Community Cohesion in Southeast San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And the district attorney put another $100,000 into that effort to implement restorative justice in the San Diego City school system. And we're now working with the National Conflict Resolution Center to take that countywide. We know this pipeline to prison exists. It starts with skipping classes, being expelled, truancy, being kicked out of school,
sure,
a juvenile record, juvenile hall, and then you're 18 and then you're into my system, where nothing good comes from that. So we're very aware, we're working very hard. We have outreach programs in North County dealing with at-risk kids. We have programs in East County that we're expanding, started in Grossmont Union High School District, and we're taking that countywide.
Very good. How is your department handling the somewhat conflicting state and federal mandates regarding undocumented immigrants, and how do you balance California's sanctuary state laws versus the Trump administration's crackdown?
Well, it's a terrible example of politics getting in the way of good public safety, and all the sheriffs in the state and the chiefs I know work very hard to really protect the people of the state of California. I don't know a chief or a sheriff in the state that wants our deputy sheriffs or our officers out there enforcing federal immigration laws. It makes us all less safe. We have, the best estimates I've seen, 250 to 300,000 undocumented people just in this county. And if you have that many people that see deputy sheriffs or police officers as immigration officers and afraid to report crimes, afraid to be witnesses to crimes, it makes us all less safe. So
very good point.
That issue I think we can all agree on in public safety. Where the rubber meets the road for deputy sheriffs is in our jails. We have a long history in San Diego County of having previously Immigration and Naturalization Service and now ICE in our facilities to screen people who are arrested in San Diego County. And if they want to take custody of them, they could. Well, the recent laws, Trust Act, Truth Act, and now Values Act, have changed that relationship and how and what we can tell ICE about inmates in our facilities. I worked extensively with the state of California, with the legislature, and personally with Governor Brown on two different occasions to try to make that more acceptable. When the Values Act started out, it said we couldn't share information with our federal partners. That was crazy. If we didn't learn anything from 9/11, it's that we need to share information at the federal, state, and local level, and we do it better than anybody in the country, in this county. And to say we can't work in those task force environments is unproductive. What we tried to do and what the bill finally says is that I can share information on release dates of undocumented people in my jails that ICE has an interest in if they have a prior conviction for one of 800 serious or violent offenses defined by California law, or have been charged with one of those offenses and have made an initial appearance before a judicial authority.
So the ones that have done something violent, or they might be a
serious
a real
offense,
threat,
been convicted that, or have been arrested that and have had an initial appearance, I can then notify ICE when that person is going to be released from custody.
Yeah.
And they can take custody in our facility.
Okay.
The downside is if they don't take custody in my facility, ICE will be in our neighborhoods doing sweeps, which we have seen that increase as there's no secret who's in my jail. Everybody that gets arrested is fingerprinted, and those fingerprints go to the FBI, and ICE has copies of that. So they know if there's somebody that's undocumented in my jail and they want to take custody of him, they're going to do it in my facility or they're going to track him down in the neighborhood. We're trying to get a good policy in place that provides public safety and keeps our neighborhoods safe.
Okay, thanks. Your department won a landmark case in which your policy for concealed carry permits was found to be legal. The court upheld this. However, some pro-gun gun ownership groups have criticized your department, claiming that it's inconsistent in issuing the permits. And your opponent has indicated he will issue them to anybody who passes a background check and a safety curriculum and provides accuracy and live fire training. I would like to give you a chance to comment on that.
Kind of correct your question a little bit there. It wasn't the San Diego County Sheriff's Department policy. It's the state law. The state law of California, and I know it upsets a lot of people because most of the states in the union, 41 states, are what they call shall issue states. If you pass a background test, the issuing authority shall issue a concealed weapon permit. California's law says you have to pass the background exam and all the other tests that goes along with it. Plus, you have to have proof of good cause. Why you need that concealed weapon permit? It's not my rule. That's the state law. I was sued. I won in federal court.
Yep.
They said that position or that requirement was unconstitutional. It went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. They upheld that, and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, where finally it got changed to, instead of the gentleman versus Sheriff Gore, it was this gentleman versus the state of California, I was just enforcing the state law. So it's gone all the way to the Supreme Court, and what I have done now, I think this policy has been the same in San Diego County for 35 years.
So you didn't invent this.
I didn't invent this policy.
Okay.
This goes back to Sheriff John Duffy and Bill Collins, mm-hmm. and then on to me. What I have done since the Supreme Court upheld California's law saying the proof of good cause is a legitimate requirement, I've tried to define those good cause requirements as broadly as I can. What we generally say is there has to be something that distinguishes you from the average person in the population to need a concealed weapon permit. Besides, they say self-defense should be enough of a good cause requirement.
So you have to have
self-defense is, I want one. What else would you want a gun carrying a concealed weapon
good
for?
Good point.
Besides that. So I'm just following the state law. Our denial rate, since I won in the Supreme Court, and we're trying to broadly define what good cause is, we only have a denial rate of about 4%.
Wow. So 96% of the people who apply actually get one.
That's one of my frustrations. There's a lot of bad rumors out there that don't even apply because the sheriff won't give you a CCW. Apply. like I say, our denial rate is about 4%. And we have more concealed weapons permits out there than Los Angeles County, which is three times bigger than we are.
Thank you for clarifying that important point. Let's talk about drugs. What is your department doing to crack down on those who are selling or manufacturing illegal hard drugs? And also, what's your approach to dealing with those who are addicted, especially with this opioid crisis that we're seeing?
Again, the San Diego Sheriff's Department has been at the cutting edge of the opioid crisis. And I think that's why you don't see it as bad and as much of a crisis here in San Diego as it is in some of your Midwestern and East Coast cities.
Interesting, which is impressive given that we're a border community,
right?
And certainly there could be some traffic.
Methamphetamine continues to be the main drug of choice here in San Diego, mm-hmm, for our addicted population. What we did starting back in 2005, 2006 was realizing that a lot of the people that were getting hooked on these opioids were getting hooked right with the medicine they found in their medicine cabinets at home.
True.
Unused prescription drugs that kids were getting a hold of,
yeah,
parents were not controlling, and there was really no way to get rid of these drugs. You couldn't flush them down the toilet. You can't throw them in the trash. Pharmacies would not take them back. So DEA started a prescription drug take back. They do it a couple of times a year. The Sheriff's Department said, what do you mean a couple of times a year? We should have drug take-back boxes in every one of our facilities throughout the county.
And we do.
And we took back, since 2005, 14 tons of unwanted prescription,
wow,
drugs. In addition to that, getting those prescription drugs out of homes, we were the first one in the state to start a naloxone program. Naloxone is an antidote for opioid overdoses.
Right. And that's been pretty effective. I understand you've saved some lives.
We had
that
to get the state law changed because my deputies were not authorized to administer naloxone. So we went, fought the battle in the state legislature, got it changed so my deputies can administer. It's a nasal mist.
You were the first in the state,
right,
to have your deputies,
right,
do this.
We started a pilot project in Santee, and now it's gone countywide. And in the 2 years we've done this, we've saved 60 lives. Basically brought these people back from the dead. But we
very
just
impressive
don't bring them back so they can go OD again. We also try to get them the service they need to break that addictive cycle in their life. That's the second part. The third part of what we've done in the last 8 to 9 months, which is paying big dividends, every time there's an overdose death in our territory, we send narcotics detectives to that scene to try to track back the source of illegal drugs, and we've had great successes. You've read in the
very
paper
good
recently about some federal prosecutions. Those were Sheriff's Department cases where we track back the source of the fentanyl or whatever the drug was, and we're making arrests and prosecuting those people.
Really important. We should note that in addition to opioids showing up on the streets, you're getting things like these elephant tranquilizers, carfentanil, that's even deadlier, much deadlier
than fentanyl. Fentanyl, I think, is 100 times more powerful than heroin, and
morphine,
carfentanil,
yeah,
is, you know, is
many
50
times worse
more
than that.
Than that. Right.
Yeah, very important. Your opponent has called for redirecting resources away from marijuana enforcement and toward what he considers more pressing public threats. On the one hand, your department has had to devote a lot of resources to shutting down illegal dispensaries, many of those in response to community complaints, even robberies and shootings and things. On the other hand, the county's only legally licensed dispensary out by Gillespie Field there hasn't really had a lot of crime problems other than, from what I understand, one break-in attempt a few years ago, and they were the ones that reported it to your deputies, and you guys,
right,
caught the crooks. Supervisors now want to roll back the clock and outlaw all marijuana businesses. What do you think is the right approach to regulating and enforcing marijuana laws for recreational and medical?
I think you have to look at the voters of the state of California. They passed it. It's legal by an overwhelming,
yeah,
pretty significant majority. And that's my job, is to enforce the laws that exist. Now, I've met with Lincoln Fish,
mm-hmm,
from Outliers,
right,
who does a great job of following the regulations. He would like to expand his operations, as would other marijuana growers and dispensaries in unincorporated San Diego County. The vote was 3-2 vote on the Board of Supervisors to not allow it.
So that may not stick after the next
so
election.
I don't know what's
we'll
going to happen. That's up to the electorate again.
Yeah.
But what, mm-hmm, we have focused our efforts on are the illegal dispensaries. Whether it be, you know, an unincorporated or some of our contract cities, and I've talked with the legitimate dispensary or medical marijuana dispensaries and recreational dispensaries, they're in full support of what we're trying to do. These,
yeah,
are the people that are out there with selling uncontrolled, unregulated marijuana undercutting the price so they don't have to pay taxes on this.
Yeah. And well, it could be dangerous. It could be laced with other things.
Absolutely.
Or contaminated with pesticides.
So
who knows what
they support our efforts to go after the illegal marijuana dispensaries. And like I say, the people of California have spoken, and it's legal in the state, and I will do everything to enforce the laws as written. And if the Board of Supervisors or the individual contract cities that we police for legalized dispensaries in those entities.
And that would include Lemon Grove and Santee here in East County.
Well, we have 9 cities from Solana Beach, Encinitas, Del Mar, Vista, San Marcos, Poway, Santee.
All of them.
So that's up to those elected officials. It's not my call.
Okay. Let's talk about homelessness. Rising housing costs, drugs, inadequate mental illness treatment, all of these things are contributing to a rise in homeless, not only in the city of San Diego, but in our unincorporated areas where we've seen sheriff sweeps now along riverbeds in Spring Valley, Lakeside, even up in Ramona, the mountain areas now. Critics contend that our county has been criminalizing homelessness, with shelters often full and no shelter at all in the unincorporated areas, another supervisor issue, I guess. Is there more that can or should be done to get help for homeless people in need while also making sure that they're not posing dangers to society with things like, you know, illegal campfires or drug paraphernalia that may be left around?
Well, as you know, Miriam, this is one of the critical issues facing the city and county is the homeless issue. I think everybody's impacted by it. Obviously, there's no simple solutions to this, or it would have been solved by now.
Mm-hmm.
Substance abuse, mental illness is a big contributor to the problem. I'm very disappointed in what not only this state, but the whole country has done when it comes to treating mental illness.
Yeah.
I am the biggest, largest provider of mental health beds in San Diego County with 2,000 beds out of my 6,000 inmates I have in my system.
It's ironic. You shouldn't have to go to jail to get mental
and
health.
It's not unique to me. My counterparts around the country and state prisons, we are the mental health providers. And until we've got to do a better job as a country of addressing that problem. Getting back to the local issue of homeless out in unincorporated in some of our contract cities, we have homeless outreach teams that we've developed, and we work with Health and Human Services partners to go into these areas, whether it be riverbeds, other areas, to try to get the services that these individuals need with vouchers to get them out of the canyons into homes. It's a gigantic problem, and resources are problematic. Recall Peter Seidler and Dan Shea, two local businessmen, recently purchased 3 large structures. They call them tents, but they're really permanent tent structures for the city of San Diego. We know that's not the long-term solution to the homeless issue, but at least it's a start. And
you can, they're not on the streets.
Bring the services to them and get the assessments done while they're in these facilities.
Do you think the county should do something like that? The unincorporated area is huge, there's basically no services.
Well, and the issue always is not in my backyard.
Yeah.
There were gigantic issues they dealt with in the 3 that they placed in the city of San Diego.
Right.
And I think, in fact, I talked this morning with Dan Shea about another facility, another structure, maybe to address the people that are in my facility that get booked into jail for repeat offenses.
Yeah.
So then if we get them clean and sober in our jail, which we can do in 30, 60 days, whatever the case may be, so when they're released from custody, they don't just go right back to the street. Can we come up with some better solution to where they go into one of these structures for continuing assessment and services? What we're looking at is possibly coming up with another structure to deal with people coming out of my facilities, that instead of once we get them clean and sober, they don't just go right back to the street. Maybe they can continue in the assessment, continue to get the mental health services and the substance abuse counseling they need. We're in the exploratory stage, but again, we're going to run into the problem of where do we put it?
Yeah, good question.
Everybody wants these, but they don't want them in their neighborhood.
Yeah, that's always the issue, isn't it? Recently, a deputy in your department was charged with 14 counts of sexual misconduct allegations by about a dozen different women, and this included some crime victims and people he'd stopped on traffic violations and so forth. And there's a claim by an employee who alleged sexual harassment against her supervisor at the department. In light of those cases, are you taking a broader look, Sheriff, to assure that there isn't any culture that fosters these kind of actions, or to change your training procedures to better address sexual harassment and misconduct?
We have extensive sexual harassment training in the Sheriff's Department. I have 2,600 sworn deputies. And occasionally one will make a mistake, inappropriate conduct, and sometimes criminal activity.
It's large department.
Yeah, this deputy, yeah. Richard Fisher, clearly was inappropriate behavior, criminal behavior. I feel terrible for the victims of his crimes, but I think you have to judge an organization. To think that you're never going to have an organization, we're the third largest in the state of California,
yeah,
have employees that make a mistake, is how does that agency, in this case the Sheriff's Department, deal with that inappropriate conduct? Do we do thorough investigations? There was allegations we were too slow in there was 14 cases that we had to investigate.
Yeah.
I think the appropriate action has been taken. This will go to the court system.
And he was put, wasn't he, on administrative leave.
Yeah. The minute the first case was identified and we did some interviews to see there was substance to the allegation, he was removed from the field, placed on administrative assignment, and then another victim came forward. We put him on administrative leave and took away his law enforcement responsibility. So our first concern was protecting the public, and second, to do a thorough investigation, an objective investigation. It was more important, once the community was safe, to do this investigation right, not just fast. And when you look around the country, at all the cases we've heard about at the national level with movie stars and politicians, we took care of business here.
Okay.
How many people have been charged with felonies like our deputy was? I think working with the DA's office, we did a very thorough investigation, and the justice system will run its course.
Okay.
I feel terrible for the victims. Nobody should be subjected to this type of treatment, especially somebody in a position of trust like a deputy sheriff.
Okay. Quick question on transparency. Your department does not provide mugshots of suspects that are booked, and yet many other law enforcement departments do. This has been, you know, something that a lot of the media has been asking for. Why is that policy that way? And is that something that you would reconsider in the interest of better transparency?
Yeah, as we've talked about before, I am the only jail in San Diego County. So if you're arrested, you're going to go to one of my jails. The long-term policy of the Sheriff's Department has been not to release mugshot photos. There's times when it could be problematic if somebody's been arrested and we were afraid that individual's photograph was put in the media could impact future witness statements. But those are rare. And this is an issue that we're examining right now. And I think we're going to, like a lot of sheriffs do in the state of California, we're looking towards releasing those mugshot photos.
And very good.
Unless there's a specific reason not to. The default position would be to release.
Oh, great. Speaking as a media person, I'm glad to hear that one. Let's talk about body cameras. Mm-hmm. I know your department implemented a pilot program. Can you give us an update on the status of that and how it's working out?
They're fully deployed throughout the Sheriff's Department.
So every deputy
has a body-worn camera. Mm-hmm. And my opponent has said we were rather slow in rolling these out, which I find to be interesting since he chaired the committee that rolled out the body-worn camera and made the recommendations that there was no problem. It was easy to pick a camera piece of equipment for our deputies to wear. But what we identified, unlike other agencies in this state, is that the body-worn camera evidence that will come off a deputy sheriff is just one piece of digital evidence that we get in almost every case now. You'll have security footage from a camera on a building. Everybody's cell phone has got pictures of it. We've got cameras and helicopters that will record video. Every interview we conduct, or almost every interview, is video recorded. And these are all disparate databases. So what we want to do is to come up with a piece of software that integrated all these disparate pieces of video into one thing, so a detective could sit at his desk and look at all this, complete his investigation, and ship it to the district attorney in that same format.
And then is it her decision when that gets released
sure.
to the public or not?
Right.
Okay.
And so that's what we did. In addition to that, well, we had that integrative piece of software, which mm-hmm. nobody else has. And second, and is just as important, was that there's some agencies that are paying $1 million a year just to store the video evidence the officers are recording. The cost of storage is plummeting in this country. So what we decided to do was come up with our own storage capability, and we're saving the county of San Diego probably $800,000 a year by doing that. And once we've made sure it works, and we will make that available to our law enforcement counterparts so they can save money for their jurisdictions too. But that's down the road a little bit. So that's the reason. Better to do it right than do it fast.
Sure. Speaking of Dave Myers, your opponent, I want to give you an opportunity, Sheriff, to respond to a fairly serious criticism that he raised where he claimed that he was transferred to the forensics lab work in retaliation for running against you and speaking out against, you know, things he says need to be changed in the department. Would you like to comment on that claim, please?
Well, nothing could be further from the truth. I've talked to people that run major companies, and that's why I look at the Sheriff's Department. This is a major company with 4,300 employees, a budget of $850 million. And my opponent was at a command-level position in the Sheriff's Department. I run the type of management team where you have to be able to openly discuss what's working, what's not, how you improve your operations. If he was a vice president at any major company and he was trying to take the the president of the company's job or undermine the overall organization, he would last about probably, you know, 2 days and then he'd be fired.
Sure. Well, but he is a public employee.
He has constitutional rights. But I felt it was important for the well-being of the organization to take him out of the chain of command. He's on a special assignment where he's doing important work about a move we're going to have. We're going to take a lot of our criminal investigative division and put it in a new laboratory at the County Operations Center. That's a big move. That's a significant move. And we want him to be in charge of the space and how that's going to be handled. He's also said we moved him into a broom closet. He's in a corner office, which is right below my conference room on the second floor of our headquarters at Ridgehaven, with windows on two sides. I mean, it's a pretty fancy broom closet. And he has a county car as his rank as a commander deserves.
Was it considered a demotion? Did he have any drop in pay?
No. There was no demotion. There was no drop in pay. We just took him out of the chain of command so that we could have productive management discussions without having certain things put into a political environment and leaked to the media, which I think would have been bad for this department and overall public safety in San Diego County.
One more question about Myers. He has been seeking a debate with you, and initially your campaign declined that because, your people pointed out, he could freely criticize you, but because of personnel file confidentiality requirements, you couldn't speak against him in that sense. And now he has stated in writing, and he even put it in an email to us, that he would waive his privacy rights to that personnel record if that's what it would take to get a candidate forum and or a debate. So would you agree to a debate or a candidate forum with him under those terms?
I think it's important. You phrased the question, I think, pretty accurately, that I'm an elected official, my life's an open book, and he can say whatever he wants about me. But his certain issues, he's protected by state law. Peace Officer Bill of Rights under state laws about me discussing his job performance, and there's significant fines that go along with that. He signed a waiver, and we went back to him and said, well, you said you will waive most of your rights, and we went back specifically after he came out with that letter and asked him, do you waive all your rights to internal affairs investigations and any discipline that might or might not have been taken? And he has yet to respond to that email back to us.
Interesting. Okay. Well, thank you for that. We'll definitely follow up with him on that one. You are a registered Republican. You're also a former high-level official at the FBI with many years there. So I would like to ask you, it's not directly related to the campaign, but I think it's important for the listeners out there. What is your take on the President of the United States attacking the credibility of the FBI, firing Director Comey and Assistant Director McCabe, and urging the special prosecutor to shut down his investigation, of which some claim is partisan, although there's a growing body of indictments and even some guilty pleas. I'm curious, Sheriff Gore, what advice or take would you offer to our listeners, regardless of their political party, for those who are trying to understand, you know, what's true here, who to believe, and just how concerned should we be over efforts to undermine our nation's top law enforcement institution?
As you pointed out, I've been in this business for a lot of years, and we, local law enforcement, state law enforcement, federal law enforcement, to be successful depend on the trust of the public. And to the extent that there are some people that would undermine the credibility of the FBI, which is widely recognized as the finest law enforcement organization in the world, not saying they are perfect, that they don't make mistakes, but I think to generalize and attack and try to undermine the Department of Justice and the FBI will not be beneficial long term. More concerned to me, I think, was the House Intelligence Committee, the Democratic report, the Republican memo, and how that became so embroiled in partisan politics. This report came out probably 6 weeks ago that criticized the FBI for a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court order that they had used in which the wiretap in a counterintelligence case. What disturbed me so much about that is the House and Senate Intelligence Committees are critical to provide nonpartisan oversight of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which by necessity is a secret court that sits in and authorizes wiretaps and electronic surveillance in counterintelligence and counterterrorism cases. I testified before those two committees back in the early 80s, 3 and 4 times a year. And there was never a hint of politics in that. And the country is the loser if that two committees become politicized and we can't trust them to provide legitimate oversight of the FBI, which is definitely needed because of this secret process that was set up in 1978. And it served us very well ever since then until the last year. And that's my big concern is that we're going to, you know, really destroy some institutions that need the public's trust.
Yeah. I mean, they're looking into very serious allegations here, not just scandals involving, you know, a president's personal life or something, but whether or not there may have been conspiring with Russia, foreign government.
I know Bob Mueller personally. I've worked with him.
Do you?
He's a man of impeccable integrity. Let him do his job, and then the public can decide what the facts are. And let's keep the political pundits out of it on the far right and the far left. Let him, he's a Republican appointee.
Yeah, the special prosecutor.
Right, and the deputy attorney general is a Republican appointee. Let them do their job, and let's see what the facts say when they're done.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much for sharing your information on that. Back to your campaign, I want to ask you about some of your major endorsements, and I see that you've gotten one very important one here from the Deputy Sheriff's Association, including a statement from Gary Moore, who's the president of that group. He specifically said that Mr. Myers' claims about low morale in the department and too many retirements, reflecting a lack of support for the sheriff, he says those statements are false, and he wanted us to point out that his board of directors voted unanimously to endorse you for re-election. So that's quite a powerful endorsement. Yeah. Who else?
Basically, I have every major law enforcement organization has endorsed my candidacy from San Diego Police Department, San Diego Police Officer Association, San Diego County District Attorney's Association. It goes on and on. Yeah. National Latino Peace Officers Association. You have to take a step back, and I'm one of the things I'm proudest of is that we don't have a problem hiring people like some agencies have in San Diego County. Our numbers, we're up to full staffing almost at all times, within 98-90% of full staffing. That doesn't happen unless morale is good in an organization and people want to work for it. We have people leaving other organizations to join the Sheriff's Department because of our morale and our reputation. We're the best trained. We're the best equipped. Probably law enforcement organizations are one of them in the state of California, if not in the country. The turnovers that Mr. Myers is talking about, we've known about for 5 years. We're planning for that. It was a hiring spike back 25 to 30 years ago, and we knew these people were going to retire because of the retirement plan they're under, and we're going to address that. We don't have a hiring problem like some agencies. That's because of high morale.
Very good. Where can people get more information about your campaign?
Well, I invite anybody to go to my website, Reelect Sheriff Gore. It's goes into more detail on who's supporting me, talks about my position on a lot of the major issues and what we're doing. And I'm as a department that makes me just proud to be their sheriff and looking forward to doing that for one more term.
We're going to let you have the last word today, Sheriff Gore. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know that maybe we haven't already asked about regarding your 9 years at the helm there in the San Diego Sheriff's Department and your campaign for re-election this June?
Well, thank you for that last opportunity to kind of a closing remarks. We are, like I say, the third largest law enforcement organization in the state of California. And when you look at crime rates. How do you measure the success of a law enforcement organization if you don't look at crime rates? We have record low crime rates. We are the lowest in our jurisdiction of any entity in San Diego County. That's good for me to brag about and pat myself and the people in the Sheriff's Department, pat them on the back. But the real winners are the people of San Diego County because they live in probably the safest urban county in the United States. I'm proud of how we've used technology, how we're adapting to some of the curveballs that have been thrown at us by the state in the way of criminal justice realignment. I think we're doing as good or better than 90% of the other departments in this state. And I'm excited about some of the challenges that we have in the next 4 years that I hope to address.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.